A warm welcome to everybody. It's a great pleasure to have Zuri Davoodi here speaking to us. Let me just quickly introduce her. So Zuri got her PhD at the University of Washington before she moved on to do her postdoc at MIT. And I believe she was already affiliated with the RIKEN research program already back then, is that right?
At MIT, no, that was actually an agreement for the faculty position.
Ah, right.
At the National Lab, so.
Okay, well then that happened only later.
Yes.
And now she's a faculty member at the University of Maryland. And Zuri got several awards and recognitions. So in 2018, she got the Kenneth Wilson Award in Lattice Gauge Theory. And in 2019, two prizes. The first one was the DOE Early Career Award and also the Alfred Sloan Fellowship, also in 2019. And yeah, Zuri works on effective field theories and lattice quantum chromodynamics and something that I find very exciting, quantum simulations and quantum computing. Right. And yeah, without further ado, it's a great pleasure to have you here, and Zuri, the stage is all yours.
Thanks very much, Christine, for the nice introduction. Let me start sharing the screen and make sure it works properly. All right, so you can see the screen, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can.
Okay, great.
Perfect.
All right, so thanks a lot for inviting me to IQC. I was just telling Christine that I have not been in Canada. I have not been in IQC or University of Waterloo or Perimeter, places I really like to visit in person at some point. But it's a great pleasure to still be here today virtually and be able to present this talk to you. So what I'm going to present is kind of a viewpoint on where we stand in quantum simulations for nuclear and high energy physics, the progress that we've made, the challenges, and kind of giving the sense of where the future might look like. The title is kind of very general. Unfortunately, I would not get to talk very comprehensively about all aspects of this program and everything that is going on. And in particular, the talk is going to have a rather long motivation and introduction. And just to give you a sense of what we have been able to achieve so far with the classical simulations of the quantum mechanical systems of interest in nuclear and particle physics, in particular matter and their interactions simulated from first principle. And based on that motivation, then we understand why we need quantum simulation, kind of a new way of computing and simulating these systems. So let's see how far I can go. But the fundamental question is how we can simulate universe from first principle. Of course, we know that the visible sector of the universe that is described by this nice, beautiful picture of the standard model, what it is, it's verified experimentally. It's a very nice theory that is already verified. And of course, the last piece of verification came from the discovery of Higgs that is sitting at the core of this picture. So at least we know that these are the underlying forces that govern the visible or ordinary matter in the universe. So on the other hand, we know that there are a big blob of questions out there that are not described by fundamental interactions within the standard model. For example, questions like, what's the nature of dark matter and dark energy? Why is that the matter is so dominant over antimatter in the universe? And questions of that nature, of course, we know the answer does not lie within the standard model and we have to go beyond. And these are the type of questions that would keep particle physicists and cosmologists busy in their research, of course. And this is kind of a classification that I'm using based on what's more conventional within the United States science community. Of course, the boundaries are not that clear, but let's just say that these are the type of questions that a high energy physicist would think about, right? But I want to argue that there are also big blob of questions and mysteries out there that are within the visible or ordinary matter sector of the universe. And in particular, we know that at the fundamental level, they are being described by a standard model picture, right? But on the other hand, because these systems are so complex and quantum many-body in nature, we are not able to start from this first principle calculations based in a standard model and make predictions for these complexities that arise, right? So again, within these classifications that people are kind of used to now, these are the type of questions that a nuclear physicist would think about in their research. And let's say that I kind of belong to the nuclear physics side of research in this field. But of course, at the end of the day, again, the boundaries are not that clear. Okay, so what kind of questions do I mean in this kind of class of questions that are related to the standard model itself? So as I said, there are complexities out there that we would like to understand how they emerge from the standard model, right? And let me give you questions about that. One of the things that we really like to know is what is the nature of the densest form of matter in the universe? For example, what constitutes the interior of a neutron star? Some of the densest, most exotic objects out there in the cosmos that we have no way of sort of fundamentally simulating at the moment because these are very complex systems. And in particular, if you think about more generally about the phase diagram of a strongly interacting matter in the universe as a function of temperature, chemical potential, and so on, we have little knowledge of that. And there are experiments out there that are trying to explore various regions of this diagram. But at the moment, our theories are mostly speculative and kind of not confirmed based on first principle simulations. There are, again, experiments that are trying to address some of these questions, particularly, for example, this facility in Michigan State University that is going to explore the nature of exotic nuclear isotopes that are kind of neutron rich, and they can tell you something about the nature of neutron rich environments in astrophysical environments as well. There are many other questions, but I also want to, from an intellectual perspective, kind of propose this question that how if you were able to run a simulation of matter and change the input parameters of the standard model itself? For example, if you change the masses of the quarks or the coupling constants of the forces and so on, would we end up with stars and galaxies, and in particular with life on Earth? For example, you can imagine if you change the masses of the quarks that are sitting at the core of a nucleon, which is building an atomic nucleus, right? And then the rate of reactions of these nuclei, for example, the helium nuclei, might change. And as a result, you might not end up with enough carbon and oxygen in the universe to guarantee life on Earth, right? Of course, we can't design experiments to answer a question like this because nature has decided on its parameters and is kind of running its course. So if we want to explore this kind of intellectual questions, we have to go all the way back and simulate everything from first principles and then change these input parameters because we can as theorists, right? So now I want to also argue that there are questions, again, within this big blob that we would like to accurately answer in order to say something about that other big blob of questions that are beyond the standard model. So let me give you an example of this, why we need this. So we know that a standard model itself presents some fundamental symmetries that are protected. So if you go out there and measure these properties and find out that these symmetries are violated even by a tiny bit, then that would be an evidence for new interactions that are playing in nature, right? But on the other hand, in order to find signatures of these violations, a lot of experiments that the physicists are running are using atomic nucleus as a target to find these effects. Let me give you an example. An exotic process out there is a neutrino-less double beta decay of certain atomic isotopes. if we observe this in experiment, that would be a big discovery that would violate the lepton number conservation in a standard model. That would also tell us that neutrinos are their own antiparticles, in the sense they are Majorana particles. So in order to find answer a question like this, you have to build an experiment, and there are experiments like this where you put together tons of these atomic nuclei that can undergo this process, and then wait and see whether this process happens. And if it does, the rate of that process can tell us something about that new physics beyond the standard model. However, to isolate that bit, we have to know exactly how the nucleons within a nucleus strongly interact. And again, this all goes back to understanding how a standard model would make a nucleus, right? And then how that nucleus interacts with this external probes. So that's very important. Another example is the dark matter. A lot of these dark matter experiments are, again, sort of a tank of heavy isotopes that are sitting there and then waiting for a dark matter candidate to come in and interact with that nucleus. And then you would observe some signature in your detector. Again, it's very important to predict how this dark matter interacts with a nucleus. And at the core of it is to be able to simulate very precisely these kind of interactions and cross-sections. So this would be just telling us the importance of having to do very accurate first principle simulations that are systematic and their uncertainties can be quantified, all right? So the question is, how can we approach these problems? Again, ideally, we would like to go all the way back to the standard model and start from there, but it's a very hard problem. And at the core of its difficulty is the fact that the interactions are strong. Basically, the strongly interacting part of the standard model, which is called quantum chromodynamics or a strong interaction physics, is kind of involving just a few particles, including the gluons and these light quarks, the D and U quarks. But of course, depending on your energy, you might involve other heavier quarks in the process as well. And this is the part of the simulation. The rest of it, eventually you can incorporate perturbatively, but sometimes because the perturbative and non-perturbative effects are entangled, you have to kind of have both in the same footing. So that's why these simulations are very hard. And I'll get at the, I'll describe more why that is the case, why these simulations are costly. So I told you about the quantum chromodynamics, which is really the quantum field theory that describes the strong interactions in the standard model. And this is an SU3 gauge field theory that is augmented with several flavors of quarks or fermions that have mass. So I don't want you to stare at all complexities of this equation. The only thing that I want to point out is that the Lagrangian of this theory has the interactions or the kinetic energy term of the quarks, the interactions of the quarks and gluons, which are the gauge fields in this theory, but also the interactions between the gluons themselves. So this is a feature that you do not see in quantum electrodynamics. The photons don't interact with each other directly, right? So because of these features, this is a very unique theory compared to what we are used to in, for example, in quantum electrodynamics or quantum chemistry or condensed matter systems. This is really a different theory, right? And in particular, what I want to say about this theory is that despite all the complexities that I talked about in these interesting exotic systems out there that we would like to explore, if you go all the way back to this theory, the input parameters that you have to put in your simulation to predict in principle all those nuclear phenomena are just the masses of a few quarks and then the coupling constant of QCD, and maybe you also put the coupling constant of QED, quantum electrodynamics. So with just a few input parameters, you can really predict the entire nuclear physics in principle, if you had enough computational power, right? The other feature is that this theory is asymptotically free in a sense that if you raise the energy of your process, the theory becomes basically free. The quarks and gluons are just free objects. But at low energies that are relevant to nuclear physics in particular, and these interactions are very strong and we cannot do any perturbation theory. And of course, this theory exhibits confinement in a sense that the quark and gluons cannot be observed on their own in experiment. They basically confine to gauge singlet objects. That's the term, okay? So what do we do then at low energies where things are strong and it's very hard to do computations, right? One way is to forget about QCD itself and use the separation of a scale or the fact that the quarks and gluons are not free, but confined into these objects like nucleons and pions and so on, and write down an effective field theory at low energies for interactions between these nucleons and pions and so on. But of course, the strength of these interactions have to be fixed, and we fix them by comparing with some experiments, right? But if there is no experiment, what do we do? That's the question, right? And these theories are limited. But because they are simpler to work with in general, this is a very promising way to think about approaching nuclear physics with higher and higher mass numbers in the atomic, in the nuclear chart. But again, as I said, ideally, it would be nice to start from the QCD Lagrangian itself, and that's what lattice QCD does for you. You can start with this QCD Lagrangian itself, but because you only have finite computational power, you basically put this theory on a lattice, so you have discretized set of points, and you have a finite extent for your time and a special directions of your lattice. So if you extrapolate the result of this calculation to infinite volume and zero lattice spacing, you get a number that then you can compare with the experiment. That would be a direct prediction of QCD with the same degrees of freedom, the same input parameter. And that's what lattice QCD program achieves for you. So it is very encouraging that lattice QCD in the past couple of years, starting from the past few decades, but in particular in the past decade or so, combined with these effective field theories, has been the way to track some of these hard questions and important quantities in nuclear physics, and is really on track to deliver, I think, on certain quantities. So that's very promising. And in order to give evidence for that, this is kind of a milestone for this field, where a few years ago, the NPL QCD collaboration in the US was able to produce the nuclear chart for light nuclei, but also light hypernuclei. These are the objects that have a strange quark in them. It's starting from the quark and gluon degrees of freedom, right? So it's kind of exactly that dream of starting from a standard model and be able to see these nuclei, these complex nuclei emerge from it without making any other assumptions, just the standard model, just QCD, right? The only caveat is that these calculations don't have the same input parameters as those of the nature. And in particular, the masses of the quarks are heavier, are larger than those in nature because of the computational cost. So in principle, if you had bigger computers, you can actually do the same calculations with the same input parameter as those of nature, okay? So this is quite exciting, but I wanna say that this study took about 2 years and a few hundred million CPU hours on the largest supercomputers in the US to be done. And it's still an ongoing program, and a lot of collaborations are making very good progress. But still, you see the magnitude of the simulations that we're talking about classically, right? And this is an example of another milestone that I was also involved with MPAQCD collaboration, where we started again from this quark and gluon degrees of freedom and were able to predict or post-dict the rate of PP fusion that powers sun, right? So we can also do this nuclear reactions of few nucleons starting from a standard model using these huge computations. So that's great. And it seems like the progress is being made, right? And then as I said, although we are really sitting at this very low mass number for the atomic nuclei that we can do with lattice QCD, because we can then match to effective field theories And then using other techniques like these up initial quantum many body techniques, then we can actually systematically go up. So although we cannot compute directly something up here in nuclear chart, but there is a systematic program that would be able to take you from down here where we can start from lattice QCD up here. So that's kind of the program that is ongoing, and hopefully in the next few years, we see real progress on that. And this then would basically support a multi-billion dollar experimental program, not only in the US, but in the entire world. So this is sort of a collection of many experiments in nuclear and high energy physics that are using the lattice QCD results and predictions to make progress and compare it with theory. So in order to say why these computations are so costly and takes years of computations, let me just talk about very simple features of this computations. I mean, of course, at the core of these computations are quantum mechanical, and that's why these are hard, right? So if you go back to the vision of sort of the way that Feynman taught us quantum mechanics, if you want to simulate a system that undergoes a transition from A to B, classically, there's only one path that would you have to consider, right, in your simulation. Quantum mechanically, though, there are infinite number of paths, right? And nature very magically does a weighted average of all these infinite number of paths to compute that transition amplitude. And if we do a simulation of nature, we have to do the same. Of course, we cannot add infinite numbers, but we can import an important sample, right? Because we know that not all these paths are important. So we take a finite number of them, but the ones that are important, and we take more and more of these samples, making the samples larger and larger to make sure that we get to the actual answer in nature as we put more computation into these problems. The other feature is that these simulations are not just quantum mechanicals, like what you're used to probably in non-relativistic settings. They are also relativistic. So we have relativistic quantum many-body systems. And these are the systems that are described with quantum field theories. This is just a schematic or sort of artistic way of saying that if you're dealing with the fields, quantum mechanically, there is a very complex configurations for these fields, as opposed to a sort of classical trivial configuration, even for the vacuum to vacuum transition amplitude. And if you're interested in the correlations of these fields or these particles that are described by the fields, you have to keep into account these complexities of these fields in the background of your calculation. You have to take them into account, right? So this is another feature. So when it comes to QCD, which is a quantum field theory of the strong force, it's really complicated. Even the vacuum state of the theory is very complicated because we have the gauge bosons, the gluons that are interacting with each other, but they can also create pairs of quarks and anti-quarks that create and annihilate each other, right? So it's a very complex dynamical object, even if you're not dealing with any particle correlations or anything like that. Already, this is very hard. So the way that we do it classically is that, as I said, we do Monte Carlo important sampling in a sense that we take these gauge configurations, these vacuum configurations, and these quark and anti-quark configurations. We generate them with some weight, and the more of these we generate, the better we can approach the right answer, right? So it requires a lot of computation to have a very good vacuum gauge configurations that we store. And then once we have those, then we calculate expectation value of observables. For example, if you're interested in the mass of a hadron, like a pion, we form a two-point correlation function and then look at this object. So it's basically a statistical mechanical system now because we have these samples, but of course we better have good samples and we better do a lot of measurements on these samples to reach the final answer that is close to reality, right? So that's why these computations are so difficult. And there are other difficulties, and I want to move on from this fast, but now imagine that all even a single nucleon or a few nucleon calculations from QCD would take years of computations on these supercomputers. Now imagine if you wanted to start computing something like radon with 200 something nucleon, it's very difficult because the complexity would grow factorially with the number of quarks in these objects. Not only that, we have very severe signal to noise problem as a function of these Euclidean or imaginary time quantum Monte Carlo computations. The other thing is the problem with the scales in nuclear physics. The excitation energies of these nuclei are of the order of a few kilo electron volts, but the masses of these objects are hundreds of GeV, for example, right? So we're talking about orders of magnitude difference between the total mass of a nucleus and then the excitation energy of that nucleus. So your computation or your simulation better be so precise to be able to resolve these differences. And given all this computational cost that is required, and this signal to noise issue, it's very hard to imagine that we will reach that precision with our current technologies and classical computations. Not only that, we also have the sign problem. And I didn't tell you about this trick when I was talking about important sampling, but the reason that we can do important sampling is that we use the trick of going to imaginary time. So we already lose this connection to real time, but also it means that if I introduce a chemical potential, then I cannot do this trick anymore because my weight of the sampling is going to be oscillatory. This is not going to be very good because then I end up with a sign problem. And that means that I cannot use these computations to explore something like this phase diagram of QCD or nature of dense matter in the universe is starting from these techniques. That's very limiting for us. On the other hand, as I said, doing this imaginary time trick would mean that we lose connection to real-time observables. And in particular, if you're interested in a wealth of dynamical response functions, distribution functions, and all these interesting physics, non-equilibrium physics of QCD, then we cannot do it with the current techniques because of, again, this very severe sign problem. So because of these, despite all this very great progress that's been made in the field nucleon sector, starting from QCD, we cannot make progress in a number of other directions with the current technologies and with the current computing. So that's kind of the motivation of my talk. That was kind of long, but I think it's necessary to understand because it tells us something about the differences that we have to expect in these kind of simulations compared to what people in quantum simulations have been thinking about so far, but also the challenges that are involved in the classical side. So maybe we can learn something from that for the quantum simulation side. But in any case, all of these are opportunities to really explore this new direction and understand how we can throw out quantum simulation to this problem. So this, I wanna stop here and see if there are questions and then I can move on.
I have a question, Zora.
Yes, please.
So on the slide where you're talking about these three challenges, your complexity growing up and then the signal to noise ratio, I didn't quite get the third point. So excitation energies of nuclei are smaller, but so what? Why is that hard?
In these computations, if I want to get the mass of a nucleon, right? Say the mass of this radon is going to be say 200 GeV, okay? So I form a 2-point correlation function ideally of this object. In Euclidean spacetime, it has a spectral representation, meaning that the ground state is going to be the dominant contribution to this correlation function because it's Euclidean space. So it's going to basically go to the ground state as a function of Euclidean time, just like this picture from below. And then I read off this number as the ground state energy of this system. But someone comes in and asks, well, what's the first excitation of this system, right? Which is going to be now 200 GeV plus a few kilo electron volts, right? Because of this signal to noise ratio, you have to have exponentially increasing resources to be able to reduce your error bars, to be able to resolve 200 GeV from 200 GeV plus a few KeV. Okay, so that's just a matter of statistics. But what I'm saying is that we're talking about orders of magnitude precision that you need to resolve these excitations. Given that you have all the signal to noise problems, it's a statistical problem, right? And it's a complex system. On top of all of that, you cannot just say, okay, I'm fine with 10% precision on my ground state, that's fine. You need one part per million sometimes precision on that number. So it's just the requirements for the program. That was the
message. Makes sense, thanks. Yeah.
Okay. Anything else?
So just to follow up, this difficulty is also basically the same as the difficulty when people want to simulate any quantum critical point in some condensed matter system, I assume.
Exactly, yes, there is a similarity. So anytime you have very increasing sensitivity, right, to whatever quantity, you better have a lot of precision. Otherwise, you're gonna miss that. And this is one of those examples, right? If you're interested in the ground state to excited state transition of this large nucleus, and then you're talking about very small gap. And if you don't resolve this energy, you cannot get this transition amplitude right.
Thanks.
Okay, sure. All right, so now let me talk for maybe then the other half of my talk or less about this quantum simulation program. Of course, what it means in the context of nuclear and high energy physics is that we're talking about maybe starting from quark and gluons, building up a nucleon, and a nucleon building up a nucleus. And then we know that the nucleus is sitting at the core of the atoms, and atoms would make the molecules make the materials. And maybe eventually you can think about something complicated like neutron stars, right? So what we mean by quantum simulation is to use systems that are fundamentally different, like atoms, molecules, and materials in terms of their degrees of freedom and the scales that are involved in these systems. They're fundamentally different from the systems in nuclear physics, but we would like to leverage these systems to be able to simulate the nuclear physics systems, whether in a digital sense or maybe in a more natural analog sense, right? That's the goal. So how can this be achieved? Of course, this is the right time to start thinking about these problems. I don't have to motivate this at all. It's a place like IQC, which is really the center of it. But we know that there is a range of quantum simulators out there with varying capacity and capability that are hoping to progress to the point that would enable simulations of this type, these physical systems for us, whether again in analog or digital fashion. So it's very important for our community to start thinking about how to kind of port our simulations into these new systems. And that's the goal of the program. So again, I kind of mentioned some of the differences with kind of quantum chemistry and condensed matter systems in nuclear physics. Let me mention a few more. Let's say that I want to start simulate a nucleus starting from the nuclear Hamiltonian. Basically, if you give me the nucleon-nucleon interactions, forget about the quarks and gluons, someone would just tell you what the nuclear Hamiltonian is. That system is more familiar or similar to the quantum chemistry problems or a strongly correlated electron system in a sense that nucleons are fermions, right? But on the other hand, the Hamiltonian is actually more complex. You don't know it with arbitrary accuracy to start with. There are short range interactions, intermediate range interactions, long range interactions. There are even three and multi-nucleon interactions. So we don't just have like two-body interactions. We can have three-body interactions or four-body interactions, depending on the density in the system. That's very peculiar. We can also have like pions and other bosons in the system that become dynamical in a sense that they can basically induce the force but they can also become dynamical themselves. You can generate them in a process, in a high energy process. So our simulation better capture all these features. Things are even more complicated if you start from the standard model itself. And the reason is, of course, we talked about this. This is a quantum field theory. It's both quantum and relativistic. We have both bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom that are dynamical and coupled. And this system exhibits not only global symmetries, but also the local or gauge symmetries. This is, again, a new feature that we have to deal with. Again, I said these systems are relativistic, so particle number is not conserved, something to keep in mind. Vacuum, as I said, of this strongly interacting theory by itself is non-trivial. So we better capture, again, all these features in our simulation. And these are some references that discuss the similarities and differences between this standard model type interactions, quantum field theory type simulations with quantum chemistry, and how we can maybe put them in the same footing at the quantum chemistry, and what how far we can go. So you can check them out. But I want to say that starting from this nuclear Hamiltonian, basically, if you just had the nucleon-nucleon interactions, what can you do? And there's been quite a lot of progress in the field. I'm going to just give you two quick examples and move on. One of the examples is regarding this problem of the response functions that you need for the problem of neutrino nucleus scattering. So this is important for experiments like the Dune at Fermilab, where they are interested in very precise predictions for neutrino oscillations, for tests of CP violations in nature. But it's very important to get the new neutrino nucleus cross sections right. And this is a very hard problem because these nuclei are very large, complex objects again. So there was a paper a couple of years ago where they discussed how if you had a quantum computer, you can design an algorithm that can actually directly compute this problem without having to go through that kind of imaginary time simulations of nuclear physics. And they kind of demonstrated the success of this algorithm in a simple Fermi-Hubbard model on a real device. So that's quite exciting, and we'll see how this program goes in the upcoming years as we get better and better simulators and quantum computers that we can use. Another problem is this problem of collective neutrino oscillations. So this can emerge if you have sort of supernovae explosions or the neutron star mergers. The neutrinos are going to be emitted, but they are not going to be sort of isolated objects. All these neutrinos have quantum mechanical entanglements between them. And so far, the classical simulations of these neutrino oscillations or coherent neutrino oscillations have been based on a mean field approximation, which basically ignores all these quantum entanglements. And there was a recent paper where they showed that if you simulate quantum mechanically, sort of in a quantum simulation sense, the small systems of neutrinos and look at entanglement entropy of the system, it actually grows with the number of neutrinos. So obviously the mean field approximation, which is kind of the zero entanglement limit, is not going to be the right approximation for this problem. But of course, it's a very hard problem and you need a quantum simulator for this. So there are people in our community that are thinking about how to leverage quantum simulators also for this problem. I want to focus for the rest of this talk on the quantum simulations that are based on a standard model or quantum field theories, as opposed to just a nuclear Hamiltonian. So kind of going all the way back to the first part of my talk where I said, at least so far, we can do lattice QCD, which starts from quarks and gluons. So eventually we would like to do the same thing with quantum computers. I would like to start from quark and gluons of a standard model, which are described within quantum field theory, and then put them on a quantum simulator and answer questions that I cannot answer so far, right? So that's the goal. So of course, in order to make progress here, we have to have theory developments. I'll talk about that in a moment. We need to have good algorithms that are particular to these systems. These have to be developed, but at the same time, we need implementation and benchmarking on the current devices so that we can hopefully impact the development of these devices in a direction that are useful for us as well. So that's very important. So let me start with implementation and benchmark and give very quick examples of these. And I picked this example of the lattice Schrödinger model, which is sort of a one-dimensional quantum electrodynamics, which has a lot of features that are in common with QCD as well. This notion of confinement and chiral symmetry breaking that I didn't talk about and things like that are really interesting and important features of QCD, but this simple one-dimensional model also has it. And really the milestone in this field, I would say, started from this work that Christine was involved with other collaborators in Innsbruck, where they were able to demonstrate that you can actually do the time evolution of quantities in this theory using a trapped ion digital computer, which was quite nice and really started a lot of excitement in this field and created a lot of other works that came along. So this is really nice. And this is the kind of things that we really need to start excite the community that these things are possible, even though we don't have large systems so far to do these simulations for, but it kind of shows you where the future might look like, right? So there were other calculations with other teams on the IBM system. We are doing a similar calculations on the trapped ion system in Maryland to kind of push the limits of these simulations to longer evolution times. And there were other works related to the potentials within the Schrödinger model. So these are quite exciting. There's been also analog simulations of the same model. Because of the sake of time, let me not go through the detail of this. We can talk about it if there is time in the end, but I just want to make sure that I mentioned that there are both digital and analog implementations of this kind of simpler model or prototype of QCD has already been started, and it's an ongoing work, and these works are very recent. So what about the theory developments, and what do I mean by theory developments? Well, as I said, these theories are quite complex, right? We're talking about a Hamiltonian that has both the gauge and fermion couplings. They have the fermion mass, they have the energy of a color electric field, and the energy of a color magnetic field. And this is for a theory that is non-abelian in this case, and is two-dimensional. And it's called the Kogel and Soskind formulation. The reason that I'm showing this is because you can describe the QCD Hamiltonian in the same form as well. So that's the ideal scenario that I can, if I can simulate this Hamiltonian on a quantum simulator, then I'm done. That's what I would like to reach, right? But the thing is that about this Hamiltonian is that gauge symmetry that I talked about. There is a local symmetry that would not allow you to arbitrarily change the charge or the fermion charge at any particular site on your lattice without changing the electric field surrounding that lattice. So it's a local symmetry that you have to satisfy. And in particular, if you schematically think about the Hilbert space of the theory, the physical sector of the theory that satisfies this kind of Gauss's law or the gauge invariance condition is very small, and it's exponentially small compared to the rest of the system, the rest of the Hilbert space. It's still an exponentially large number of states that you have to consider in this sector, but itself is a very small compared to the rest. So that means that there are some redundancies in the formulation that might not be in your favor, in particular if you're doing an imperfect simulation that would take you out of that physical subsector and would not get back. And this was an exploration that we did with the SU2 gauge theory in 1+1. So it's not quite QCD because it's not SU3, but just kind of pushing the limits at the moment, doing the SU2 in one dimensions. But what we wanted to see is how the size of the physical Hilbert space, this blue thing, would compare with the size of the full Hilbert space in this theory. And as you can see, there are orders of magnitude difference between the size of this system, even for a small values of the cutoff on the bosonic excitation. Something that I didn't mention is that because we have the bosons or gauge fields, these can occupy infinite number of excitations at the same site. And as a result, we have to cut them off. Otherwise, we don't have enough, again, resources to simulate them in this Hamiltonian simulation. So you have to devise a cutoff and make sure that things would converge to the right value as you change this cutoff on the excitation of the bosons. But in any case, this was really eye-opening for us to think about maybe we need better formulations of these theories to start with, to put them on a quantum simulator. And then we explored various different formulations of the same theory. And you can look at this paper that I've mentioned here, but sort of the punchline of the paper was to compare the cost of Hamiltonian simulation, just using a classical exact diagonalization method, not even quantum simulation. We compared the cost of the Hamiltonian simulation for different formulations, and we saw exponential improvements in some formulations compared to the other. And therefore, we realized that, for example, this loop string hadron formulation, and that it starts with just gauge invariant objects, as opposed to starting from the most general Hamiltonian and then building the Hilbert space, as opposed to starting from a Hamiltonian that is already in terms of gauge invariant objects, actually can perform exponentially better than the other approaches. So these are the kind of theory developments that I'm talking about. Even before starting to put these systems on a quantum device, you better make that formulation more efficient for your computation, right? So it requires a little bit more investment on the theory side so that you don't have to worry about a lot of resources later on. And there's been quite nice progress recently in two-dimensional quantum simulations and the kind of theory developments that I'm talking about. You can talk to Christine, for example, about how to get about this problem in a two-dimensional case that is going to have its own complexities. There's going to be algorithmic developments that are required as well. And I'm not gonna talk much about this because of time, but there's been a scale of field theories starting from the work of Jordan Lee and Preskill and other works. There's been a lot of investment in understanding what are the best quantum algorithms, for example, doing a scattering problem in these theories. There was also a recent paper that is quite nice in terms of being comprehensive in resource countings for quantum simulation of lattice Schrödinger model, and where they look at the near-term and far-term cost of the best algorithms that they can come up with for simulating the time evolution of the Schrödinger model. These are the kind of investigation that we need in this field as we go up in dimension and go moving towards QCD to come up with the best algorithm, as well as identifying or quantifying the resource requirements for these algorithms. So with that, I'd like to go to the next part of my talks in the last few minutes. And I think this would have been the part that a lot of people that I know would be interested in. So I apologize that I'm running out of time, but I try to cover this quickly. But if there are questions about this previous part, I'd like to pause for a moment and answer any questions that you might have.
I do have a question.
Sure.
So I guess it's not clear to me how you can simulate a quantum field theory with a quantum mechanical device. It seems to me that, you know, you're losing all those degrees of freedom by going from the field theory to the quantum mechanics. And so do you have an intuitive explanation for why it might work?
Well, it's one step better than what we already do, right? Doing quantum field theories on a classical device. So it's not perfect, right? If we had a quantum field theory simulator already, that would have been the perfect step. But the intuition for this is that, well, we understand that these relativistic theories, field theories, are described by fields. If they are fermionic fields, there's a nice mapping, might get complicated in higher dimensions, between the fermionic fields on the lattice and the qubits. it's going to be more complicated for the gauge fields, as I said. So you have to come up with a mapping as well as a digitization of these fields that makes sense, that would take you to the infinite cutoff limit of these digitizations fast. So that's the limitation, right? So if you had a quantum simulator that had intrinsic bosonic and fermionic, like the cold atom systems, that would also have the gauge invariance built in, and naturally, that would be a perfect system for these quantum field theories. So I agree with you. It really depends on the capabilities of these devices at the moment, but it's one step ahead of what we already have in the classical side.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Anything else? All right, so in the next 5 minutes or so, I try to motivate why I think that this theory experiment co-development is really key to progress in this field. And we would like to know whether really nuclear and high energy physics can impact the quantum simulation hardware developments. Kind of goes back to these previous questions, right? Given the features of our system, quantum field theories, what are the best simulators out there that can represent these theories without having to do a lot of hard work to do this mapping between two intrinsically different systems? So the system that is closer to my heart, because I work and talk with trapped ion experimentalists in Maryland, is this trapped ion simulator. Of course, as an analog simulator, this is a very powerful tool. Because if you just introduce these ions in this confined potential and then use this global Raman beams to the system without any individual addressing, really, then you can still simulate. And let me not go through the physics of the ions because of the time. Let me go to this picture. With this analog simulator, you can already simulate something like the Ising model, which is an all-to-all long-range interactions. Basically, you can simulate any pattern for these interactions as you want, as long as it's kind of this power law pattern and the alpha power is between 0 and 3. And you can introduce a magnetic field in these systems, right? And this has been already very powerful tool for analog simulations. This is an example of looking at the dynamics after the quench of a long spin chain and sort of observing a dynamical phase transition in a system that you can't really easily do that with your classical resources anymore. So this is really pushing the limits. Even with this simple analog simulators, that have this sort of global addressing. You can make the system even more capable by introducing a set of individual laser beams that are addressing these ions individually. And then this system is going to be used as either a digital quantum computer or a highly capable analog quantum simulator as well. You can talk to Rajabul and others at IQC about how to optimize these interactions by using this kind of optimization of all these probes in these individual beams. So in terms of the digital computers, there's been a lot of interest and a lot of advancement, of course, as you very well know at IQC, because you're building and owning these devices. But this is a picture of using a quantum computer with the ion trap quantum computer to find the grounded state energy of the deuteron, the lightest nucleus. So you see already nuclear physicists are trying to do very simple problems using this near-term ion trap quantum devices. But what I'd like to focus on here is a work that we did to expand the capabilities of these trapped ion analog simulators for problems of interest to us, say lattice gauge theories or nuclear physics problems. So the first step, what we did was to introduce more probes to the system with very particular orientations of the global and these individual laser beams and certain frequency detunings, such that we have more knobs to basically tune or optimize to get these gauge field theory simulations that we would like to get. And in particular with this system, you can simulate a Heisenberg model Hamiltonian basically introducing these couplings between the XX, YY, and ZZ spins independently of each other with a lot of flexibility, which is very important because, for example, the lattice Schwinger model can actually be written down in terms of a Heisenberg Hamiltonian, which has both nearest neighbor and all-to-all long-range interactions with certain patterns. So as an example, we just solved the optimization problem for getting nearest neighbor interactions out of a system which is basically intrinsically long range, but using these optimizations and more probes in the system, more knobs in the system, we can make them perfectly nearest neighbor. Or you can, for example, induce this kind of long range interactions of this particular type, the Coulomb interactions in the Schwinger model, again, perfectly using these knobs. You can also do this for two-dimensional gauge theories that you can write in terms of the spin Hamiltonians. And in particular, again, by doing the mapping of the two-dimensional system to a one-dimensional chain of the ions and doing the optimization problem, you can perfectly get the matching of the couplings that you require for your lattice gauge theory, in this case, the Chern-Simon theory in 2+1 dimension. So that's quite interesting. And these systems are now being built, would take a couple of years to have this kind of capable analog simulators for these kind of problems. But we also are thinking about, again, expanding this toolkit of the trapped ion quantum simulators, because not all the theories that we're interested in, including QCD, which is really our dream, is going to be accessible with this simulator that we designed. We would like to go beyond that. And that means that we have to think about adding more knobs to this quantum simulator and thinking about more features. So in this particular case, and I don't have any time, I'll finish up in a minute or two, we thought about kind of extending this Molnar-Sorensen type spin-spin interactions to an spin-spin-spin interactions. And in this case, we basically use this trick of adiabatic elimination to eliminate the two sort of internal spin levels and kind of directly entangle the, for example, three spin downs with three spin ups. And in this case, you can just run the numbers and find out that you can actually be perfectly fine the parameter regime where you have only three spin correlated transitions without having any amplitudes in the other two levels that are in the system. This is sort of a schematic of what I was talking about, kind of coupling three spin down and three spin up through this kind of extended Molnar-Sorensen type interactions. And we're kind of excited about the prospect of this. We're running some numerical simulations that seem very promising. And in particular, if we actually add this capability to what, for example, Crystal has at IQC working on multi-level ion simulators, if you actually kind of enhance those simulators with this scheme, you can actually look at the gauge theories that are more complicated. For example, within the quantum link model of Schwinger model, you can have a system that you can simulate in fully analog fashion in a way that has not done before for using these trapped ion simulators. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there to think about how we can expand this toolkit for the problems that we'd like, but that requires talking with experimentalists and learning about these systems and really telling each other about the features of our problems or our experimental systems in a way that we kind of make them more capable for these particular simulations. And with that, the summary is basically, let me just go to this final plot. We'd like to start from a standard model, calculate observables in the few nucleon systems, fix effective field theories, use them in many-body nuclear structure calculations to get to very interesting physics about neutron stars and neutrinoless double beta decay and supernova explosions and so on. But this is a very hard computational problem with our classical resources. We would like to really facilitate this program or expedite this program using quantum technologies and quantum simulation. And we're really just starting now, I would say. And this would be exciting to see how it proceeds in the next decade or so, and whether there's enough excitement left even at that point. Hopefully that would be the case. And with that, I'd like to say many thanks to the funding agencies that made all this research possible, but most importantly to my collaborators, both in Lattice QCD side. So these are the results that I showed kind of in the first portion of my talk. But nowadays with my collaborators in the quantum simulation field, and these are primarily people in Maryland and that are belonging to many different communities, not just nuclear physics, but as you can see, both condensed matter, AMO, QIS, and a number of faculties, both theorists and experimentalists that I have the privilege to talk to and work with on several interesting problems. With that, thank you very much. I'll take more questions.
Great, thank you. Thanks a lot. That was an exciting talk. So do we have questions? Yes.
I have a question.
Sure.
Angus, go ahead if you have a question.
Oh, okay. So I actually have like two questions, but I'll ask one first. So it's more of a big picture question. So you mentioned in the very beginning, like what's interesting to high energy theorists or nuclear theorists is what happens in like hot dense nuclear matter, for instance. And I'm wondering, so within this, I guess like hot dense nuclear matter physics, on the top of my mind, I can think about like, you know, nuclear fusion or fusion processes. And I guess you can simulate this with like Lattice QCD. And how large of, let's say, a fusion process in terms of lattice sites and CPU time are classical calculations limited to? Like, what is the state of the art?
The state of the art is actually the slide that I showed you on PP fusion. That's as far as we've gone, really, just fusing two nucleons together. If you want to start from the fundamental quark and gluons, and I don't find that the slide, I think it's here. This is a state of the art so far, and it's not even with the input parameters of the standard model. These are with heavy quarks that are heavier than what they are in nature because of the computational cost. But again, this calculation was using the same vacuum configurations of the previous plot on the nuclei. It took about 2 years to generate. And it took about, I think, less than a year to do measurements or this expectation value calculations for this to be able to compute the rate of this process starting from the quarks and gluons. So of course, you might argue that, well, you don't want to start from the quarks and gluons all the time. You may have to think about going through this sort of step-by-step matching where you start from your effective field theories that are already good enough to describe with the precision that you'd like a nuclear fusion. And in that sense, we have fusion calculations using these nuclear many-body techniques that are not starting from the quark and gluons. They're starting from nucleons themselves and the ab initio interactions between the nucleons. And they can go, if you want to be really ab initio, then they have done something order of 10 nucleons. But then you can be even more go to this more approximations, right? And there are nuclear fusion and fission calculations that are beyond that, but they are not really quite ab initio, right? So you start to build up a lot of systematics because of these approximations. If you're not starting fundamentally from your fundamental theory of QCD, but that's all we can do at the moment. I mean, these are very hard problems. So if you're interested in the fission problem that occurs in a reactor, this is like beyond what we can do today or even in the next couple of decades with lattice QCD, unfortunately.
I see. But do you think, let's say, a quantum algorithm of lattice QCD on a quantum computer would significantly speed up, like instead of a few decades, maybe half that?
As long as we have these systems, if you give me something that has at least 10,000 to hundreds of thousands of error corrected qubits? Yes. Anything below that at the moment, I don't think so. I mean, these quantum field theories have very huge resource requirements. Even for the Schrödinger model, I showed you this plot or the table of resource requirements from this paper. And I don't know if you noticed some of these numbers, the number of, so it's not even the number of qubits here, but in terms of the number of C0 gates for near term or T gates for far term, given the accuracy that you require in the strong coupling or weak coupling limit, we're talking about tens to hundreds of thousands of C0 gates, for example, even in near term. So the requirements for these calculations are high, very high. And imagine this is just one dimensional theory, quantum electrodynamics. It's not QCD in 3+1 dimension. And so it's going to be even higher, but that kind of is the scenario that was the case for classical computations of these systems. If you talk to some of my colleagues that are more senior, I don't think I was born at that time where this field was born. People were doing 4x4 lattices using classical computers because of the capabilities were very low at the time. And nobody, even the most optimistic people, thought that one day you can do PP fusion from quark and gluons using this program. But things changed over 4 decades or so. So that's why lattice gauge theories, because of this experience, are more optimistic than maybe some other disciplines in terms of the reaching where we want to be in a couple of decades, so.
Okay, thanks.
I had a question regarding what you said about the lattice QCD. Sure. So you mentioned that you were able to model some properties of nuclei, but that these weren't like sort of what we have in nature because we assume the mass of the quarks is much larger. So I'm just wondering, when you make that assumption, what approximation can you make that increases your sort of efficiency or like reduces your runtime?
Very good question. You're basically asking, why is that if I make the mass of the quarks heavier, I have to run much cheaper calculations to get to the answer? There are various reasons for it. One of the reasons is a plot that I actually wanted to talk about, but I, in the last minute, I made it, I think it was here. I skipped this one because what it requires in these calculations is to evaluate the propagations of quarks from one point to the other. And from the mathematical point of view, what this means is that I have to evaluate this quark propagator, which is inverting a very large matrix, okay? So in this case, I have this example for a very common lattice size that we use these days. And the size of this matrix is actually 300 million by 300 million, okay? So these are the entries of this matrix. You want to invert this matrix. It turned out that if the quark mass is very small, like what it is in nature, then this matrix is very singular. And inverting it would require a lot of resources, right? It's badly conditioned, and therefore to reach a certain accuracy, you really need to crank up your computation. So the heavier the mass of the quark, the better we can do with this inversion. And that's just one aspect of it. There are other parts of the computation that can benefit from heavy quarks. But I should say that for a lot of lattice QCD calculations of different observables, we are doing these calculations at the physical point with the physical light quark masses, no problem. It's just that for these nuclear type calculations that it's very difficult at the moment. But if you're interested in the mass of the proton or the spin of the proton or how the proton interacts with other, so just like a single nucleon, not a nucleus, we can do the physical point calculations, no problem, with precision, so.
Okay, so even for the large mass, the matrix dimension doesn't change, but
no, it doesn't. The
numerical conditioning does.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
So I have a question regarding your ion trap, the three-spin interaction that you showed.
Yes.
For the analog. the scheme that you showed, yeah, I mean, in principle, that can be done. But then, of course, the challenge is your amplitude is going to go down.
It's a slower. It's a slower process. That's correct.
That's right. So my question is more like, do you have, I guess you, okay, so you have this plot, so that will give me the answer. It's a much slower process. And, but let's say somebody is trying to do some very proof of principle experiment involving this free spin. How many, like up to what time in units of one of our effective three spin coupling you need to observe in an experiment to do anything interesting as a proof of principle experiment?
So in terms of the oscillation cycles, if you can actually show that, so I think the very first principle should be able to show that you create a pair of up, 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 down, 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 a GHZ pair basically. So that would be really the first building block, which would require that you at least go for one cycle, right? I mean, if you think about like at this point, for example, you have that mixture. So if you can generate that pair without having to worry about the intrinsic spin-spin interactions, which are going to be in your system. So that's the challenge, right? So if you want to observe any pure three spin interactions or transitions, you better suppress the two-body interactions because those are going to be dominant. And that's the challenge, and that's where a lot of tricks come in to be able to get rid of those so that you have these pure spin-spin interactions, three spin interactions that are, although slower, but they are the dominant transition in the system. So in that case, you can observe them. So that's really sort of the goal for us now, that the experiment, given the parameter range that we are finding out of our numerical simulation, could be able to demonstrate this to start with. But whether or not it would be useful eventually for doing a full analog simulations of lattice gauge theory, we'll see, right? Because I mean, these are slow processes, and given the decoherence in the systems at this time, it might not be possible with the current technologies today, but hopefully in the future.
Yeah, so my question is more for the second part, which is to do something useful, over what time scale do you actually need to observe?
For the lattice gauge theories.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you look at the implementations of the lattice Schrödinger model, as long as you can show the pair creation and annihilation out of the vacuum, which would be quite early in the simulation time, you can see it, you have already seen something interesting, and that doesn't require a lot of evolution time. But of course, if you're interested in the scattering of two hadrons in the Schrödinger models, high energy scattering, and you're interested in observing the asymptotic states and see how they look like, then you need very long simulation times. And at the moment, I don't think we have them in either digital or analog simulators. But these are very good questions. These are the type of questions that we and everyone has to think about at the moment. What is really the minimum requirement to see something interesting in either of these models, right?
Okay, thank you.
Since you are talking about time, Rajibul, we are also kind of running out of time, but we do have time for one last question.
Can I ask a question?
Okay.
Can we have two questions?
Yeah, let's make it two. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. So in the last part, you were describing some smart ways to design the parameters of the Hamiltonian you want to simulate.
You mean this part?
I wonder, in the experimental side nowadays, how well can people control the parameters of the Hamiltonian they want to simulate, either for the purpose of nuclear or high energy physics or condensed matter physics?
You have a lot of experts at the IQC to answer this question, but I'll try my best. So as I said, a state of the art at the moment is kind of this, this configuration, where you have a set of Raman beams where they can address each ion individually, but you also have the frequency and amplitude control over each of those laser beams as well. So what that means is that you can perform the gate, but you can also perform highly tunable Ising model type Hamiltonian. So that's the state of the art at the moment. This you can do. And I think given the technologies, each of these sort of beam, you can address up to 30 or 40, I think, at the moment. That's kind of the state of the art for individual addressing of the ions in digital computers. But the other system that I talked about that requires kind of three sets of global beams in all directions and three different sets of tones farther apart so that you don't have all sorts of contaminations. This is something more complex, and this has not been implemented yet, but we're at least my experimental colleagues are working towards realizing a small instance of this system in experiment in the next couple of years. But I think you can get more a better, more expert answer from Rajabul and Crystal and others at the ITC. So.
But maybe let me just say one thing. So I think my question actually contains two parts, and you answered the first. So the first part is technology-wise, how people can control the knobs they control. And the second part is given that they are very able to control the knobs, how well do they know what exactly the Hamiltonian is that they will try to simulate?
Given the imperfections of the experiment, as well as the imperfections of the effective Hamiltonian in the sense of not being really effective, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
You have to work it out for every system. So like for this optimization problem, we said, all right, we need perfect nearest neighbors. And this is the set of parameters that we can find from our classical optimization. But is it really true that with this set of parameters, if I plug in this into intrinsic Hamiltonian of my system and run it, that gives me this effective, beautiful Heisenberg Hamiltonian, and not all this sort of contaminating first order terms and higher order terms, right? So then we had to do the simulation. We had to run the simulation to see what is the magnitude of all these contaminating terms to make sure that for the set of parameters that we find out of optimization, we actually are controlling up to a few percent all those extra things that we don't want, which are not part of our life as Hamiltonian. This is very important, very difficult. So in a sense, it's a very constrained optimization problem. It's not a simple optimization problem, so.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for the great talk and for giving me this opportunity to ask the question. So at IQC, we're also building analog quantum simulators based on Rydberg atoms. And they also realize Ising spin models on two-dimensional lattices. And my question has to do with, as we build those simulator, is there something like a nuclear physicist wish list in terms of controllability, dimensionality, connectivity, in terms of system size and current time that that exists that could guide us as we build those simulators?
Absolutely. I mean, if you ask me in a few months, I will have better answer for you, because we just started in the past few weeks or so discussing this with my colleagues on the cool atom side. So we have Alexei Gorshko and Mohammed Hafizi and others who think about the theory side of these cool atom systems and Rydberg atoms. So I'm talking with them and we're trying to figure out whether the current technologies and experiments are capable enough to do some simple instance. And of course, I mean, a lot of people are working on this. If you ask Christine, she knows more about this than I do. But, and then figuring out whether we should propose some more capabilities for these systems that are doable for these lattice gauge theories. And we're interested in non-Abelian case at the moment, but of course the Abelian case is hard and interesting to start with. But that's kind of what I said. I mean, we really need to talk to people like you as an experimentalist and theorist on the AML side to figure out. I mean, the first thing for me is to understand what you guys can do at the moment, right? Before that, it's very hard to make progress. So hopefully I have better answers for you. And maybe we can discuss more if you're interested.
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much.
Of course.
Okay, great. such a lively discussion. Yeah, amazing. I'm very happy about the talks, the discussion. So thanks a lot for everybody.
Thanks very much. I really enjoyed it as well. Thank you.
And also everybody who asked questions. And ciao, ciao.
Thank you.